welcome to the Sprocket Podcast, where we are simplifying the good life. My name is Brock Dittus.
And I'm Aaron Flores, broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
Cascadia, which is now covered in a thin blanket of snow.
Yeah.
Actually.
And ice.
Yeah. Where are we in the intro?
I just mentioned where we are.
Cascadia.
Yes.
We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally, with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
Covering bicycling, trains and transit, and simpler living. And today, surprise, surprise, cars.
Car sharing.
And sharing.
Yeah. Yes. We're here with Steve Gutman from Get Around, and also you're a sustainability expert, right? You know more about sustainability than anybody else.
I would never claim that title, but I've been interested in it for a long time.
Well, thanks for coming in.
You bet.
And yeah, we are in the middle of the Snowpocalypse 2014.
Snowpocalypse 2?
It arrived.
The electric boogaloo.
Yes, and depending on how long you've been here, maybe 3 or 4 or...
That's true.
I think I've weathered 3 intense winter storms since I moved to Portland. And this one was not as bad as the last one, as far as I remember. But
this is my first.
Is your first?
This is my first.
Oh, yeah, because you got here after. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
What are your impressions?
That it would be nice if we had in our city budget the ability to rent snowplows from other districts.
Right, because at one point there were only 2. And I feel like I've seen more than that rolling around town recently. But
I haven't seen a single one.
Oh, you haven't? Okay, no. All right.
No, my road is still covered.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one that I saw, the joke, of course, being like, is that number 1 or number 2?
Right,
but
right.
I feel like they've outfitted them with, I think there are more city trucks, like big dump trucks that are outfitted with plowing mechanisms these days.
A shovel or whatever in front of.
Yeah, a big cow catcher.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's been happening. But yeah, school was canceled on Friday, so I didn't have to go into work, and I got Friday off. Saturday and Sunday, I spent a lot of time actually doing party bus stuff because we had some gigs planned.
I can't believe you guys still went out and all of that.
I can't believe we did either. I think it was kind of like, you know, wanting to deliver and hoping it wasn't as bad as it was. But Saturday night when we had our first gig, it was actually, that was when the, I want to say sleet, but freezing rain started to happen. And we were supposed to go to Hood River. And Hood River is out in the middle of the Columbia River Gorge from whence all the cold east winds come. And that was, it was happening at exactly the time we were trying to go there.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just, it was a matter of not enough traction and not enough defrosting power. Like with defrosters on full blast, we were still getting ice freezing to the windshield,
right,
and that sort of thing.
You had mentioned like you get ice on the outside, but then everybody's hanging out and partying on the inside.
Right, right. So you got body heat, which increases the, yeah.
So it's steam on the inside.
Yeah. And it's an old bus. So it's not, it's functional, but it's not as sturdy enough to handle that much condensation in that cold of weather. So we made it to Troutdale in 2 hours, like crawling along the freeway, 35 miles an hour, 30 miles an hour. And that was when I was like, you know what? I don't think we can do this. And so we brought everyone back to Portland, and all the hippies were sad. But what can you do? It literally was kind of a bus full of hippies going to see a bluegrass show out in Hood River. So we felt bad because like everybody wants to go, but it was kind of a, like, you know, it's just a safety call.
Right, right.
And this is the thing. It happens once every like 5 to 8 years because, well, Steve, you were in Portland in 2008, I think, when
that was
the first big dump.
Oh, no, there have been ice storms for forever.
Right.
I grew up here
since
1973, and there have been some really bad ice storms. This was nothing.
Right. And the ice storm is the thing that, it's a phenomenon that doesn't happen in a lot of places. The geography is really unique because, like I said, the east wind comes down the river through the gorge and into this, like, confluence valley. And like even I grew up in Tacoma, we don't get ice storms in Tacoma really all that often. And I think it has to do with the river and the atmospheric conditions. And so, yeah, it like people from other parts of the country, and I'm thinking of Phil, who wrote in and criticized us for being pansies and not being able to ride.
I was thinking about him
freezing
all
weather.
Weekend.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, part of it is just being used to it, because like if you bicycle or if you go out and walk, if you're an active transport person of some kind, if you're not used to it, that's one reason that you wouldn't bode well for you. And no one in the Pacific Northwest is used to extreme temperatures, so that's part of it. But the other part is that this ice thing doesn't, I mean, obviously people have ice everywhere, but I feel like the ice sneaks up on you here like it wouldn't other places. Like other places, the ice would be around for a while, you would know it was there. Here, it shows up, kind of like pops up from behind the couch or something, says, "Hi, I'm here, the party started." And yeah, and no one knows what to do with it.
It's freezing rain.
Right.
I mean, it's rain that hits the ground and freezes. And you know, a few years ago, I mean, there must have been a half inch of frozen rain on the streets. And we literally went ice skating on the street outside my house. Put on ice skates. And I'm not kidding. This was many years ago. But I mean, the power lines were covered with an accumulated 3/4 of an inch of ice and coming down, and tree branches were coming down.
Yeah.
And it's astonishing. And that didn't happen this time. So.
Right. Yeah. I think Adele saw someone ice skating.
Really?
Unless it was you.
No, it was
not. Okay. I feel like I heard a story about that this year, but like certainly not for very long.
Right.
So in your, just being in Portland this long, like what's the worst storm in your memory? Like,
I can't put a date on it,
but
it was the ice storm that I'm describing.
Okay.
Because ice, when it's a half an inch thick, is heavy, and it brought down massive numbers of tree limbs, and there were power outages and
trees
falling, and it was a big deal.
Yeah,
people were electrocuted.
Right.
Oh, wow.
And lots and lots of car accidents.
It's like fallen power lines, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because I mean, the weight of all of that ice on a power line will. It'll bring down power line poles.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was January 2004 is the one that I remember. That was before I was a carless individual. And I was driving from Vancouver over the 205 bridge, and the freezing rain had just begun. And I lost traction in my, 72 Valiant? It was this big, heavy car. And did a full 180 and slammed against the wall, separating the freeway from the drop into the river.
Holy shit.
And I'm here to say that those things are stronger than you think they are. It's great. But that was a very scary experience. And that was the day, I think that was the beginning of the cold snap that year, where like for 5 days, many people's cars were just frozen into the accumulated snow and the MAX service was down. And I think eventually Mayor Vera Katz issued like an edict to all of the public employees saying, if you work for the city, you are coming into work today. No matter how you get here, you have to come to work, because it was like 5 days of total shutdown. Hmm. And I lived in Vancouver at the time, so I was actually staying like on a friend's couch for about 5 days.
I was going to say, did you even bother to go back?
No, my car got frozen into there was the snowdrift and then there was the sheets of ice over it, and I couldn't get the car out of the snow.
Wow.
So I'm sure if I had tried harder, maybe I could have, but even then, I didn't have chains or anything with me. You know, I was 23 or 21 or some age in which you're not equipped to deal with the forces of nature. So, yeah. Winter can be intense, so especially if you're not prepared. Anyways, it seems like it's slated to leave us, right?
More or less. Yeah, they've been saying that. Like, it's been getting warmer.
Yeah.
It's really not that cold, though. It's just...
It's raining now pretty steadily.
Right.
Everything's just slush.
Oh, yeah. You were like all wet when you came in.
Yeah. It was. It's raining and slushy out there.
But
it's not going to drop below freezing tonight. I don't think.
Let's hope.
It wasn't supposed to last night either. So
the next week is just when it washes away.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the drains are full. And of course, if you live somewhere else in the country and you want to heap ridicule upon us, it's thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. You can tell us what pansies we are and how we can't handle the elements, and we'll say, yes, we're right. That's exactly the case.
My tires just aren't wide enough.
Oh, I did see Dan Kaufman shared a video of a guy in like a big swamp truck. It was like this raised truck with huge balloon tires.
Okay.
That was losing traction around the Rose Quarter, I think it was. And like just sliding backwards, and it was kind of funny, and it was also kind of like, oh, he's going to ruin his vehicle, and I'm sure he was probably scared too.
I bet.
But yeah, that was kind of intense. Just things go to shit here whenever it gets cold. So
yeah, it's partly the drivers, and it's in our own defense, it's partly the inability of the city to cover. I mean, they just don't have the equipment.
Right. Exactly, the two snowplows don't do enough.
And I wouldn't suggest that the city buy a bunch of snowplows for like the one time in every 4 or 8 years where the city gets covered.
Definitely,
Yeah, in fact, I think when it snows, it's one of the most wonderful times in Portland because nobody's out driving. I went cross country skiing 3 times.
Yeah, how was that
over the weekend? And it was lovely. I mean, it was like you were out, you could take the lane.
Yeah,
there were no cars coming in any direction, and I went out with my 2 daughters. One's 8 and one's 11, and we were out 10 o'clock at night cross country skiing on the street.
Our apologies for a little recording mishap here.
We'll fill in the gaps somehow.
I think it's probably like a minute out or something like that.
Okay.
Well, we'll reset. So, Steve Gutman, let's talk about car sharing.
All right.
Again, the evolution was Dave Brook, you said, was one of the people who began thinking about this in Portland?
Yeah, so this guy named Dave Brook, who's still in Portland and he's still involved in the industry, I believe he traveled to Europe and he heard about this. Well, he heard about this thing called car sharing that was starting to sort of, you know, gain a little bit of traction, I think in Germany, and he went and researched it. He came back to Portland, and my understanding is a little murky, but I think he sort of tapped out his retirement plan and started a little company. After much debate about whether it should be a for-profit or a non-profit, he decided to do it as a for-profit, at least nominally, and cleaned out his retirement account, invested his money, and I believe it was four Dodge Neons, something like that, and basically a touch-tone reservation system and a clipboard is, I think, how he began it.
Interesting. Touch-tone, like just like a telephone.
Yeah, yeah. There was no internet at this time,
right?
I mean, and there were no like online reservation systems. There were no telematics technologies. The way his system worked is somebody would call, 866 or 1-800 car sharing, and somebody would pick up, and they would the caller had to be a member, and they by becoming a member, they would have had their driver's license screened to make sure they were insurable.
Okay. They had to apply for an account.
They had to apply for an account, yeah. And then they could book a car for as little as an hour and as long as a day. And there were hourly rates and mileage fees. And anyway, they talked to some alive person initially and booked a car.
Okay.
And at the time of their reservation, they'd be given a PIN code, and they would enter that code into a realtor-style lockbox at the location where one of these four cars were parked, and would open up the lockbox, grab the key. The key was, I believe, not an ignition key. It just would open the door.
Okay.
And then the actual ignition key was inside the car.
So like a four-step process or something.
Yeah, it was. I'm not sure the logic behind that. But anyway, that was the basic process. And at the time, my wife and I, we weren't married at the time, actually, but my girlfriend, then girlfriend and I, we didn't have a car. We had just spent 2 years as school teachers in Italy, and we'd lived in Rome without a car. And prior to that, you know, we were pretty, I would say, pretty pretty committed to the car-free lifestyle.
Okay.
So we went and lived in Italy for 2 years, and then when we came back, we decided we were going to live right in the city, and we were going to try to continue to live this car-free life. And it was all working pretty well. I was working at a sustainability-focused small bank called Shore Bank Pacific, which is no longer around, but it's been acquired by another local bank focused on funding sort of green startups.
Okay.
Called One Pacific Bank. But anyway, Shore Bank Pacific was my employer, and I was basically at the bottom of the totem pole doing financial analysis. So I never had to go anywhere. But then I was promoted and became a loan officer, so I had to go out and meet with clients. And as somebody who rode his bike to work every day, this was going to be a problem. And so my boss actually suggested that I buy a car.
Yeah. Your clients are probably far afield. They're not a bike ride distance, at least not like in a reasonable amount of time for the workday.
Yeah, they were like composting centers and organic dairies and that sort of thing. And so I had to get in a car. And so I was then, faced with this problem of potentially having to go buy a car. Well, right around the same time, Dave Brook was starting Car Sharing Portland.
Okay.
And he came in and actually asked for a loan because he wanted to buy a Honda Insight, the very first hybrid vehicles.
Yeah.
They were the space age looking ones, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The rear wheels were covered up.
Yeah. So long story short is Car Sharing Portland became a client of the bank. I became a customer of Car Sharing Portland, and I used, you know, these car, one of the, you know, these four cars that they had and or the hybrid to visit my clients. So yeah. I became the first business, sort of the first business account, the first person to use Car Sharing Portland for business purposes.
Okay.
I think I was member 23.
There you go.
But anyway, I don't know, fast forward maybe a year, and Dave helped start FlexCar up in Seattle.
Yeah. And so that was from Seattle originally?
Yeah. It was founded in Seattle by, you know, a group of people up there with consulting help from Dave Brook, who had started Car Sharing Portland, which was the first car sharing company in the United States.
Okay.
And it started right here in Portland with four cars in, I think, 1998 or 99.
Which is kind of a cool story.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so what ended up happening is FlexCar got an investment from North American Honda. And with that money, they agreed to merge with Car Sharing Portland. Car Sharing Portland went away.
Okay.
And FlexCar became a car sharing company in two cities, Seattle and Portland.
Okay.
And shortly thereafter, they hired me away from the bank to do basically business development for FlexCar.
Sure, and you had experience with car sharing, and so it was probably a natural choice. Like, this guy already knows the system, he uses it, has all these insights in how it works. And so you were kind of like suspect number one.
Exactly. And anyway, so they gave me the job. I basically went around and talked to architecture firms, engineering firms, and city agencies about how foolish it was for them to have a bunch of cars that are sitting around idle, you know, all but 2 or 3 hours a day.
Sure.
And instead, they should rent cars by the hour. Because just backing up a second, car sharing is a system, for those of you who don't know, where basically a fleet of cars is owned by an entity. It can be a nonprofit or a for-profit. But those cars are made available for rent by the hour or by the day, but with gas and insurance included in the hourly or daily rate.
So you're paying a flat fee as opposed to having to factor all these things in and chase down all the paperwork.
Yeah, it's the fully loaded cost of using a car for, say, 3 hours, right? Might be $7 an hour. And the beauty of that, sort of from an active transportation perspective, is it takes this thing that car owners, they have a lot of fixed costs. Like, a car costs anywhere from, you know, $300 to $600 a month to own.
Yeah, and many people are making payments as opposed to having bought it outright, so it's an ongoing cost.
Yeah, they're making payments, or even if they bought it cash, it's still depreciating $200 or $300 a month in value.
Sure.
Right, even if they, paid for it outright, and they're having to pay insurance and occasional maintenance and, you know, gas, all the rest of it, occasional parking or parking tickets. So it becomes a very, very expensive endeavor.
And if your serpentine belt goes out, then...
Yeah. And car sharing, by contrast, takes that... But most people, when they think about the cost of owning their car, they don't think about all of those things. They only think about the cost of gas,
right,
which is actually somewhere around 15% of the actual cost of owning your car.
Uh-huh.
Right? So everybody complains about gas prices, but what they don't realize is that's just a very small part of what they're actually paying to own their car. Even if they bought it outright, because it's losing value month after month after month.
Sure.
Anyway, so what car sharing does, it sort of flips that on its head, because there is no fixed cost to being a member other than maybe a $50 annual fee. But every time you use a car, it's pretty painful because you're paying $6, $7, $8 an hour. And so as a result of that phenomenon, it's a little bit like, we used to use the analogy, it's like eating at a la carte instead of at the all-you-can-eat buffet.
Right.
Owning a car is like you walked into the all-you-can-eat buffet, and so you're going to pig out every day. And no matter, whether you're hungry or not, you're going to have three desserts, right?
Sure.
Whereas if you're driving a la carte and you're paying $8 for every hour of vehicle access, you do things like make shopping lists, and you do things like bundling all of your trips. And most people who use car sharing services, they actually, on average, drive more than 50% less than people who own a car, okay? And some people who, what was it? And in the process, they end up saving. I mean, the average car share member, this was, an old statistic, but it used to be they spent about $150 a month for roughly 25 hours of access to a car, versus, if you believe AAA, it costs today something like $700 a month fully loaded to own and operate
a personal car.
Yeah, which is a lot.
That's a lot of dough. It's the second largest household expense after
housing. After a house payment.
Yeah. After housing for most people. Right. So it's a huge cost, and you can convert that high fixed cost into a variable cost that the individual has full control over. At least almost full control over. I mean, some people just need a car at least once a week, but other people, including my wife and me, we rarely used a car. I used the car for work to visit my clients, but other than that, we would, you know, we would use car sharing Portland a couple hours a week on average. So it was a very, very low cost, but it took away this nagging, you know, desire to buy a car because we didn't want to harass our friends. You know, there was like, before car sharing Portland came along, there were times when we wanted to go to the Gorge, or we wanted to go to the coast, or we just, you know, wanted to go get something. And this took away the sort of the need to buy a car.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, this was back in the day when, I mean, today in Portland and in many other cities, living car-free is utterly commonplace.
Right. And bordering on cool in certain age brackets and certain environments.
Bordering on cool. And back in the day, my wife and I used to be introduced at parties. This is Steve and Amanda.
Those two.
They don't own a car.
These are our poor friends.
And we would just, you know, and anyway, I mean, we did it because we liked it and we enjoyed the lifestyle, and also because we were pretty committed to that as a, you know, for sustainability reasons or whatnot. But we also found that we just always had more cash in our pockets than most other people were, like, worried about car payments or worried about this. And meanwhile, we, you know, we bought a condo and we're making two payments a month.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it was amazing how easy it was to save money. And we were both school teachers at the time. We weren't like, you know,
sure.
We weren't like awash in making high salaries. We were school teachers and then I worked at a bank as well. But not having a car was a huge savings, and people really don't recognize it. And what car sharing does is, because of that conversion of a fixed cost to a variable cost, it gives people a very direct incentive to drive less, to bike more, to walk more, to get a transit pass. They realize that transit is actually quite cheap.
Compared to having to like take that shot in the arm of paying for the car every time you use it in a really like cognizant way,
exactly.
Like you just feel that pain. It's a zap. I'm curious, Aaron. Do you how much do you deal with the like, this is my poor friend who doesn't have a car? Because I feel like I've had that a lot. Because I have a bunch of friends from like, you know, earlier in life than now that I still hang out with on an occasional basis, and it's kind of like this weird wall between us.
I get it more when I go back east.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, especially, you know, where I grew up, where there's miles and miles of nothing, you know. It's such an oddity that I would rather just walk from one place to another.
Then get the ride and take the shit for not having a car.
Right, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, generally I only visit over there during the summer where it's really nice, where like, yeah, why should I sit in a car and I'll take the extra 15 minutes and walk over to like grandma's house or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. So you've been in this for a while. Now you're a part of this thing called Get Around. And we know the major players in the game. There's Zipcar, which absorbed Flexcar, which, as you're saying, absorbed Portland car sharing. So it's become a big thing. It's available in a bunch of cities. Zipcar is certainly in Boston, where my in-laws are, and all over the rest of the states. Car2Go is in a bunch of spots. I believe they just went into Seattle. So next time I go up there, I'll have access to that.
Used it there last weekend.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I like Car2Go because it's that whole point-to-point. Like, you know, just you don't have to worry about where you're going to leave it. But then Get Around is this is like taking it to
this
the next
is the
level.
New thing.
Yeah. And I've described it to people as like Airbnb for your car, kind of, because people are familiar with like renting a house or a room from somebody when you go traveling. Is that accurate?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, in the Bay Area, many people refer to where Get Around is based. Many people refer to it as the Airbnb for cars.
Okay, yeah.
And it really it's really that. It's very much like Zipcar. There are few things that differentiate it, except that Get Around doesn't own any cars. It's simply you can think of it as a brokerage platform. It's a platform where anybody who owns a car that meets the insurability requirements can upload photos of their car, set an hourly, a daily, a weekly price, add a description, set the calendar of when the car is available, and then they're in business. And what GetAround provides is a really cool mobile app, and a web app as well, and then a really interesting insurance policy that the founders actually went to the California Insurance Commission to get it legalized, but also went to a major insurance carrier, Berkshire Hathaway,
okay,
and had a insurance policy designed specifically for this industry. And it's a liability comprehensive and collision policy that replaces the policy of the liability policy replaces the policy of the owner during a rental.
Okay.
And by state law in California, Oregon, and Washington, the owner of the car is actually indemnified should something happen while somebody is using their car. And not only is the owner indemnified, but the owner's personal insurance is indemnified.
So right. It's basically like it's a no-risk proposition?
Well, what GetAround provides is a stand-in-place policy that replaces the policy that is covering the owner and the owner's car, and it's okay. also covering the renter, so the renter doesn't right. have to have their own coverage. And whereas, it's arguably a no-risk proposition, although, I have to caveat that because we haven't had any case law. There haven't been any major disasters in Oregon, Washington, or California where, four people have died as a result of, somebody doing this. And so to say that there's zero risk, until something terribly tragic happens and it winds its way through the courts, we won't know that for sure. However, there's a you can visit GetAround's website. It's getaround.com/insurance. And that is a summary of the insurance with a link to the legislation that was passed and signed by the governors of Oregon, California, and Washington that actually makes peer-to-peer car sharing legal and makes it illegal for your personal insurance carrier to drop you or impact your coverage
because you're car sharing. Okay, oh, wow. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, now a lot of insurance brokers don't even know this exists. Right. Okay. So if you tell them I'm going to put my car on GetAround, they'll say, "What's that?" And you explain it to them, they'll say, "Well, that violates the terms of your personal policy." And, we can't have you do that because it's like, if you read your personal insurance policy, it will clearly state that the commercial use of your vehicle is not covered
right.
by our policy.
So if you were going to use your own car for a taxi or for business deliveries or something like that, it would be that would be a violation. But GetAround is this kind of in-between sort of place that makes it okay.
Well, what GetAround did, again, is got a law passed that says if you are renting out your car through a peer-to-peer car sharing company and that company provides a commercial insurance policy that replaces and indemnifies your personal coverage, if you're doing all of those things, then, it's a completely legal activity in California, Oregon, and Washington.
Okay. So is that the scope of GetAround at this point?
Yeah. Basically, the company is... It's really focused on San Francisco right now.
Okay.
There's a little bit of an outpost here in Portland. There's an outpost down in San Diego. And then we're also operating in Chicago and in Austin, Texas, because of some different sort of insurance laws. I'm not really sure of the details of that. But fundamentally, the company is based in San Francisco and is really tackling the San Francisco market right now. And then I would say later this year it will begin to expand beyond San Francisco pretty aggressively and sort of re-enter Portland, San Diego, and other areas around the Bay, around the Bay Area. But right now it's 95% of the company's attention is on San Francisco.
Sure. Yeah, and that's a big market. There's a lot of people living down there. So and it's dense enough that I would imagine that it would probably be not maybe more useful, but there would be maybe better access. Does that seem right? Like,
there's a huge amount of demand.
Okay. Yeah.
I think the statistic is 1 in 3 households in San Francisco doesn't have a car.
Okay. Yeah.
And everybody likes to go to wine country once in a while or to IKEA to do some shopping or whatever.
Right. And that's the biggest problem I think with low car lifestyle is that like the things that I enjoy doing when I owned a car are harder to get to. Like going out, say, even to, I was reading the Willamette Week's beer guide, and there's a couple of new breweries in Carson that I would love to go to, but there's the only bus that goes out to Carson only goes on weekdays, and it's only like 3 times a day, usually when I'm working. So, either you have to have a friend with a car, or you have to rent one from a private company, which is a boatload of paperwork and a hassle, or without car sharing, you just kind of write it off and be like, well, I guess I'm stuck in the city. So this kind of fills that gap of like, we can still go out when we want to, but it's not a personal drain on my own finances if I'm car sharing. And it's also not, I don't have a habit built in where I'm using the car in the city, contributing both to environmental degradation and laziness, just bad habits. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So do you share your own car?
I do.
Okay. How's that going for you?
It's gone just fine. I mean, I don't share it that often, but I think I rent it for $450 or maybe it's $550 an hour.
That's an incredibly low number compared to the commercial car sharing companies. I don't know if Get Around would consider themselves commercial or not, but like the big names like Car2Go and Zipcar.
There's a difference, though.
Costs a lot more to rent theirs, right?
Yeah, I mean, in their defense, one thing that Get Around doesn't include in the cost of the rental price is gas.
Okay.
So when somebody uses my car, you know, if they're going to go 150 miles in 3 hours, they are just as well off going and using a Zipcar.
Right.
Because gas is included. If they're going to use a car for 5 or 6 hours and just run a bunch of errands in the city and only go 15, 20, 30 miles, that's a gallon of gas, then paying $4.50 or $5 an hour for the use of my car is a bargain.
Right.
Relative to paying, you know, twice that for a car that includes gas. So it really varies. One thing I will say is I think that these car sharing companies, you know, they're complementary. What people who are pretty savvy about this kind of a lifestyle, myself included, I mean, I use Car2Go. There are times when I rent out my car for a day and I'm making $40 renting out my car for a 24 hour period, but I need a car for 20 minutes because I got to get somewhere in a hurry. And so I'll, you know, I've coined a phrase called carbitrage. I'm making $40 so I can afford to spend 40 cents an hour to use the Car2Go for 10 or 15 minutes. And
sure.
I do that. I do that all the time. And in fact, even if my car isn't being rented, sometimes I'll use a Car2Go. For example, I used to fly down to the Bay Area for my job pretty frequently. I'd get up at 4:30 in the morning to catch a 6:30 flight, and I would take the Car2Go from my, you know, the closest one to my house to the MAX station, and then I'd ride the MAX to the airport rather than paying $60 round trip for a cab
right
at that hour.
Yeah,
or
definitely.
Driving and then stranding my wife without the car and, you know, paying for airport parking. You can take a Car2Go for, you know, $3 or $4 to the MAX station, ride the MAX. And anyway, I mean, there are, you know, I think, again, people who live this car light lifestyle, I don't want to call it car free because obviously it's not.
It involves cars.
Right. It does involve cars. But you get pretty smart about which company to rely on for which kind of trip.
Sure. And it's kind of a multimodalism in a way of choosing the system that works best for you at the time that you need it.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, fundamentally, I mean, and I think this is interesting. One of the things that has happened for me is, you know, you get a car and it's sort of a slippery slope. You start to use it, you know, more and more over time. I mean, I noticed the mileage was sort of creeping up. But then when I posted the car on GetAround, it sort of started reversing itself because now there's an opportunity cost to using your own car. Because if you're not using it, you can make money off it.
Yeah.
Right? So it's interesting. And that's less of a factor here in Portland where the market is not very well developed. But in San Francisco, the average GetAround owner is now earning $823 a month net in their pocket.
Wow.
And that's after, you know, GetAround takes a hefty chunk of the total that a car earns. I mean, we take 15% roughly for our own commission, but then Berkshire Hathaway or the insurance company takes another 25%. So you're actually left with 60%. So if you have a really nice car in San Francisco and you can rent it for, say, you know, $10 an hour, only six of that is hitting your checkbook at the end of the month.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
But even with that 40% commission, you know, there are roughly, I don't think, you know, over 300 people in San Francisco who are averaging over $823 a month off their car. And those are cars that are essentially set up with onboard telematics that make their car function exactly like a Zip car.
Okay.
Except when they block it off for their own use.
Sure.
But at other times, people just, they reserve it, they show up, they unlock it with their smartphone, they get in, they drive it. When they're done, they do still have to gas it up. But once they've gassed it up, they just park it, and you know the bill hits their hits their account, and it's super convenient. And in terms of convenience, it's very rapidly approaching the convenience of Zipcar.
I was thinking technology has evolved quite a bit since this got started. Like you were saying, you used to have the lockbox with Portland car sharing where you'd have to get one key out then get the other key. And now you've got, you know, like Zipcar, last time I used them was a couple of years ago, I think. But you could use the mobile app if you have a smartphone to unlock the car for you. And so, yeah, there's all this technology, not to mention GPS and those sorts of things that really help you. You can do a lot more work with a lot less of your own personal time to make all this possible and to make it happen. So what's the setup with GetAround? Because I thought I heard that there were like kits that you can install in your car. Is that how it works?
Yeah, so there are really three different ways to configure a GetAround vehicle. One is with no technology at all. And if you don't put any technology in the car, what ends up happening is essentially you get requests to rent your car. If you accept that request, then it's incumbent on you to meet the renter at the car and hand them your keys.
Okay, like a face-to-face contact.
Yeah, it's a manual key exchange. That's sort of the old-school, low-tech way. And, you know, we have thousands of cars across the cities where we operate that are set up that way. Now, a subset of all of the cars... We have roughly, in the United States right now, we have roughly the same number of vehicles in GetAround that Zipcar has, and probably more at this point, because, you know, there's no downside, there's no cost to somebody adding their car to the system, so more people add their cars all the time.
Sure.
So, but most of those have no technology in them. If somebody wants what we call a car kit, the car kit is an electronic device that's very much like the telematics unit that's in a Zipcar. It's a device that has a GPS chip in it, and it allows communication between GetAround servers and the cars. Okay, so I have one of these car kits in my car, and what the car kit can what it facilitates is renting out my car if I'm not around. All I have to do, if I know I have a rental coming up, I can leave the keys in the car, and I can have it configured so that the ignition won't even start unless there's an active rental on the car, right? So then my next door neighbor needs a car, they rent my car, and at the time, the minute after the rental begins, they can show up with their smartphone, unlock my car, get in,
the
ignition's
and the
activated,
tells it's okay,
and off they go. So that's, but the car kit, this is a little bit arcane, but it can be configured in two ways. It can be configured for request mode, where I, as the owner, have to accept or decline any rental request, and they come in as text messages on my phone.
Okay.
And I can either, you know, look at my calendar and say, yeah, take it, or, ooh, no, my wife needs the car, decline, whatever. That's request mode. But there's also a new mode, which we've been piloting for a year now in San Francisco, and it's not available in Portland yet, but it's called instant rental, or instant mode, and that is essentially just like Zipcar.
Okay.
Okay, the renter looks at the calendar. If the car is available, they block off the time they need the car, and they reserve it. The owner gets notified that their car has been rented, but they don't have to respond and say yes or no or whatever, because they have proactively blocked off the car for their own use.
Right, and they're not assuming that they have access to it at any point.
Well, if they can block off access.
Right.
But they have to do that proactively.
Right.
So people will typically block off the car for, you know, their yoga workout and their weekly shopping. And then they can also go out up to, I think, 6 months on the calendar and block off weekends when they want to use the car for themselves. They're planning a road trip of some kind, so they can block off the car. But unless they or another renter has blocked off the car, it's open season on that car, and whoever wants it, as long as they've been approved by GetAround's, you know, insurance screening process, can book it and access it using their smartphone.
Yeah.
And those cars that are set up for instant rental are the ones in San Francisco whose owners are averaging over $800 a month in revenue.
Because they're available so many times and so often during the times when people want them.
Yeah, and because it's so convenient.
Yeah.
Because renters, one thing that a renter does not want is to have to, A, meet somebody, because somebody's always like 5 minutes late, and then you're like standing by your car waiting for this person to show up.
Right.
And the other thing they don't want to have to do is they don't want to have to go through the request process. Can I use your car? Yes or no? And then, you know, somebody might take 30 seconds, or they might take 2 hours to respond. And in the meantime,
you could be indisposed for some time.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, we call the nomenclature we use is the owner and the renter. So the owner, if the owner is in a meeting and they can't respond to their text message or their phone is dead or whatever, yeah. Then you know renters can be very frustrated. So what GetAround has found over the past 2-3 years of operation is that this instant configuration is the way to go, and they're building the whole product around it, and it's, you know, and it's doing very, very well for people who have their car configured that way.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
I was doing a kind of a cooperative car share. It wasn't widely available. We weren't renting to strangers, but it was like 4 or 5 of us. One person had a car, and a bunch of different parties were kind of coordinating how we would share that vehicle when people needed it. And we did something kind of like that with like a Google calendar setup, basically, where we all shared the calendar, and then we would put in like, oh, this is when we're going to be gone. But it was this enormous reorientation. This is what you're talking about, of kind of making the shift from my car is available to me anytime I want it to I have to plan to use my car because other people are also depending on this. And it's an interesting shift, and certainly not for everybody. Like, again,
absolutely.
I mean, if you're say you're an emergency responder and you live at home and you need your car like on a moment's notice to go drive a fire truck or an ambulance or something like that, that's a good reason to have your own vehicle, I think. But
absolutely,
yeah,
absolutely. And one other thing though that GetAround does to sort of mitigate that issue is people who qualify for instant rental, because you know there's a bar that they set. You have to have a pretty nice car. The car has to be available at least 50% of the time, and every other weekend day on average. So anyway, they have all these different criteria. But if you qualify and you put your car in, they'll give you 2 coupons for 50% off the rental of somebody else's car if your car is being rented when you find yourself needing a car.
Oh, there you go.
So they sort of help mitigate that problem a little bit. And because there's so many cars, and again, I mean, in San Francisco, they've gone from 0 instant cars to over 300 in less than a year. And it's, you know, I think they're now getting probably 6 to 8 requests a day from people who want to put their cars into this system. The amount of liquidity in the system is growing really, really quickly. And as that happens, the level of convenience becomes way better than any other car sharing company because there are just so many cars. I mean, there are, I think it's 1.15 cars per licensed driver in America.
Right.
So there's this huge oversupply of vehicles.
There should be enough for to go around.
Yeah, I mean, if GetAround gets 1% of those cars into its network, you know, it must be roughly 200, there must be 200 million cars, right? So if they got 1% of those, that's 2 million cars that would be in the network.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's more than any transit agency has in their fleet.
Well, Zipcar, after 15 years of operation or whatever it is, has somewhere between 10 and 15,000 cars.
Yeah. Right?
So, I mean, and again, this is the power of this peer-to-peer model, because these are all assets that somebody has already purchased and is already maintaining and is already insuring. And all you're doing is leveraging those existing assets, right? So the potential supply is practically unlimited.
Definitely. And what you said about liquidity, I like the word, because it reminds me of Spinlister, which is kind of like the bicycle equivalent of the peer-to-peer sort of resource sharing model.
Yep, my bike's listed on Spinlist.
Mine too. I haven't rented it yet. But I think they were briefly called either Liquid or doliquid.com or something like that. But because of the idea that like this is a fluid resource that we can share, we can pass from one person to another, and it makes sense to liquidate it in this way as opposed to keeping it in a solid asset that you can't do much with and doesn't give you anything. Right. So... yeah, I like that idea. I'm curious, just this is kind of a out of left field question, but self-driving cars, do you see any future in that? Because it's hotly debated, I think, in active transportation circles.
Yeah, well, I do, actually. I think the self-driving vehicles, and this is something that I've actually written an article, you could find it online, about where I think car sharing is going. And I'm not a car guy, and I'm not somebody who's, you know, into like auto utopia or anything like that. However, if you think about this scenario for a minute, I think it's quite interesting. Think about a mashup between Car2Go, right? All of these cars, and driverless car technology. Imagine for a second if every Car2Go were actually an autonomous vehicle.
Sure.
So you think just tap your little card on the windshield, you get in, and it drives you to where you need to go.
Well, not only that, but you open up your smartphone and you say, my daughter needs to go to soccer practice and I'm really busy. Come pick her up. So right you on. Tap on this thing and this little smart car shows up
so
at your door.
So you've also got an automated
it
chauffeur.
It sends
there.
You a text message.
Yeah.
You yell at your daughter, get out there, the meter's running. She hops in. You tell the car where to drop her and it drops her off. Now, that does a number of things. First of all, it frees up enormous amounts of time for a lot of time-starved people
right.
who are chauffeuring kids around and don't want to send their kid with some random cabbie, right? Or throw them on the bus because they're too young.
Right.
And there's a perception of safety, whether it's, you know,
sure.
real or not. But it opens up car sharing, the car sharing market to, you know, again, people too young to drive, people too old or infirm to drive, people who have some sort of a disability, whether they're blind or, you know, physically disabled and can't drive.
Or people who
and
are too drunk
who
to drive.
People who are drunk.
Yes.
Yeah. People who are too drunk to drive.
Right.
And this is the thing about driverless technology. I mean, it exists. It's being tested. I mean, there's a pilot project going on somewhere in Sweden with, I think, 200 Volvos that
okay.
are going to be used. And I think they're going to be used as a car share fleet.
Interesting.
And it opens up all kinds of interesting possibilities. If you think about these little car-to-goes, imagine they're all electric vehicles. But the minute the battery charge gets down to 40%, they take themselves offline and they drive themselves to a charging space, right? And they have these
automated.
Inductive
yeah.
charging pads. They can recharge the batteries. And when they're back up to 90 or 100%, they drive back out. And when a user, if you're used car to go, every time you use that system, you mark whether the car is dirty or not. Well, if it's dirty, it takes itself offline, drives itself to, you know, the car wash.
Right.
Gets an interior exterior cleaning. What that will do to the cost of running a car sharing organization is revolutionary. Because, you know, and this isn't a good news job story, but the main expense of car sharing companies is owning and operating and managing all those cars.
Sure.
Right? It's
being,
you know,
a wrangler.
It's buying the cars, but yeah, it's moving them around, rebalancing them, getting them cleaned, getting them maintained, all of that stuff. And all of those costs with self-driving vehicles go away. The other thing that I think is really interesting about it is the cars can, like, in the middle of the night, they can recharge and clean themselves when they can't be generating revenue. They can park themselves in out-of-the-way places. But again, they also can become super convenient for a full range of people to use that today, you know, they're not in the car sharing market.
Sure, yeah.
And I think what happens if, you know, if this technology really does take off is, you know, it could end up being like massive numbers of autonomous vehicles driving all over the place. However, if they're priced correctly, then I still think you can maintain the beneficial impacts of car sharing in the sense that if it's still more expensive to take the autonomous car than it is to take the autonomous bus, people are still going to commute by bus or by bike before they jump in that, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's still
so
going to be.
You still don't have, you know, hopefully anyways, highways choked full of people
correct.
In their autonomous car riding by themselves. So long as you price it correctly.
Yeah, and I think it can be priced, you know, through things like taxation. I mean, you know, you can have congestion pricing, you can have, you know, mileage fees or whatever. I mean, you can give people there are all kinds of ways to incentivize people to continue to use cars as their means of last resort, as car sharers already do.
Right.
I mean, people who have adopted this lifestyle do not commute by car, by, you know, nobody commutes by Zipcar or by car to go.
Certainly not, or every day.
You know, not every day.
It would be cost prohibitive.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And as long as that cost structure remains in place, I think what you could end up with is a huge, and I've been quoted as saying this before, but I think an order of magnitude reduction in the number of cars in the city is not outside the realm of possibility.
We could have more livable cities.
Far more livable cities, and also the opposition to urban density would decline immediately if suddenly there weren't as many parked cars fighting for parking spaces.
Yeah,
right?
Because when you think of like a city full of a bunch of people and each one of those people has a car, like that's going to lead to intense traffic and intensely dangerous situations on the street. If
an intense difficulty in finding a place to park.
Yes, yes, which is all rolled into the package.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's, you know, that's sort of a thought experiment. And I think, again, like I'm not somebody who, you know, hopes to ever own a driverless car.
Right.
And I don't think it's a gee whiz really cool technology that everybody's going to want.
It's not the Jetsons.
Yeah, that's not the scenario that I think ultimately, well, that I hope will prevail. I mean, what I hope we'll see is autonomous vehicles that people can essentially, it'll be like basically like a fleet of taxis.
Sure.
That is driving itself around and delivering people to where they need to go. But like in places like New York, you know, they'll primarily get around by walking because cities will be dense enough to support a full range of services nearby, or bicycling or riding public transportation for most of their trips.
Yeah. And then these would serve a purpose, something like an escalator or something like that.
Well, a purpose like a taxi or like a, you know, like a car share vehicle
does
today. It's the same kind of thing.
Okay.
But again, with a wider clientele because, you know, kids could use them and
the barrier to entry is lower.
Yeah, the barrier. Yeah exactly.
Okay.
You don't have to be a driver in order to be a car sharer.
Yeah. So the only thing that's missing is Asimov's five rules of robotics or whatever. Yeah. What were you thinking, Aaron?
I was going to say it also decreases the likelihood of getting your driver's license as a rite of passage.
Right.
As well. It's just that sort of cultural given that,
right,
you know, now, at least as a male, like now I'm a man because
I have a truck.
I have a car or a truck or whatever.
Yeah, which incidentally, I mean, that rite of passage is already, you know, I'm sure
it's
you
on
guys
its
know.
Way out.
It's on
certainly.
Its way out, absolutely.
Yeah.
That ship has sailed.
Yeah.
And good riddance, I say. The smartphone has replaced it, which I'm also ambivalent about, I suppose, but what can you do?
Yeah.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for sharing a little bit about this. It's getaround.com is how you get in touch. For people who are outside of the purview of GetAround, what would you recommend to them?
I think anybody can go to the site and sign up, and I think I'm not sure about this because I haven't tried it in a long time, but I think what they'll get is a message that, you know, sign up. Basically, you can start to create a profile and onboard your car, and
okay.
you'll be notified as soon as the service expands to your area.
So you're ready to roll when Iowa becomes a get-around destination.
Yeah, and you know, that may sound implausible, but the progress that the company is making right now in San Francisco is remarkable.
I mean,
it's really starting to, you know, it's been 3 long years of developing the technology and getting it honed in and everything, but it feels... like it's starting to sort of reach some sort of a tipping point.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, getaround.com. And with that, well, thank you. And shall we do some headlines, news?
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Oh, you're very welcome.
What can compare with the thrill of a brand new bike?
I like my bike. It's fast.
Pedal just as fast as we can into the daylight. Pedal just as fast as we can into the nightlight. Pedal just as fast as the leg.
All right, from Bike Portland, Chicago brings Portland's bag of biking tricks to Brownsville's Black Metropolis. Can a Portland brewed program that uses free events, maps, and t-shirts to get people informed and enthused about biking and walking, can it work on the inner south side of Chicago? With the help of experts from Portland's top bike planning firm and two advocates in Chicago's Brownsville community, the city gave Alta Planning's Jessica Roberts and Kathy Seiber 3 months and $200,000 to create a customized temporary version of Portland's Smart Trips program in a mixed-income, overwhelmingly African-American community where bikes have never been a big part of city life. Brownsville advocate Lakeisha Hamilton said it wasn't personal health that seemed to really win people in Brownsville to thinking about bikes. It was pollution. Our air quality is so bad that they went and got money to come and fix the problem, Hamilton would tell residents. 80% of Chicago's funding for the Brownsville program came from federal grants tied to the Clean Air Act. As in many communities near freeways, asthma rates in the area are disproportionately high. Every time I spoke, I pointed out about the air quality. When people just froze and said, man, I didn't think about that. I saw the light bulbs flicker. Those were powerful moments to me.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool thing. And we just talked about street trips last week, I think, right? Timo had written in and directed us towards that. So, yeah, this is a great article, well worth the read. But it's cool to hear, you know, especially like places that are not necessarily thought of as bicycle friendly, coming out as bicycle possible, that yeah. people would embrace a trend that that makes them healthier and makes the quality of life better. So I am a fan.
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait to hear more from them. And also can't wait to hear more from, also from Bike Portland, Brandon Rhodes, Lent's new bike-powered grocer.
That's our former co-host.
Brandon Rhodes, former co-host. By 2020, Brandon Rhodes predicts and hopes Lent's will finally have a grocery store. For now, it's got him on his bike trailer. Rolling Oasis is a weekly produce delivery service that's ending the Lent's food desert one bike ride at a time. So far, Rhodes has more than 20 households signed up for the home deliveries of fresh organic produce, $20 a week. His service in the Southeast Portland neighborhood near the intersection of Southeast Foster and Interstate 205 starts March 1st and will continue year-round.
And I'm excited to see what he comes up with a rig, because I think he's looking into getting a new bike. He's looking into getting a bicycle trailer, and I don't have any of the specifics. I don't even know what kind of pants he's going to wear when he does this. So, but we've been writing about it. So anyways, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing this kind of come into fruition, as it were. It's a cool project. We're proud of him. So, yeah. We got some mail.
We got some mail.
We got mail. Hey, we got mail.
I think I'm going back to being ashamed of that.
It's pretty entertaining, I got to say.
I was like, you know, for a while, I was really entertained by it.
But now you have to hear it for...
I've recycled back to the original shame.
The rest of time, yeah.
Yes. All right, first, Kirk Twitters. My new favorite podcast is the Sprocket Podcast.
Aww.
Check it out for excellent bicycly stuff. And rural Iowa roads are quite hilly. Many rolling hills, flat in a car, on interstate, but hilly on a bike.
For our continuing discussions of Ragbri, apparently. Mm. And what this hashtag, I don't understand what he means by it.
God's handkerchief.
Are you familiar with that phrase?
No, not at all.
Okay, neither am I.
I know what handkerchiefs are for.
Is that where God blows his nose, apparently? Or something?
In Iowa?
I guess. I don't know.
Are there a lot of large green rocks in
it's
Iowa?
Good question. I have no idea. It's the only tweet with that hashtag on the internet.
Oh, really?
Say that, yeah.
Maybe it's just like this random phrase he pulled out.
Which I am no stranger to. Yeah.
That would be awesome. Scott Cohen from the city of Portland writes in to clarify how demand for bike parking works. If you want to request a bike rack for a business, you can. Check the website for all the ways to request a rack. However, the city won't install a rack without the business owner and property owner's approval. So my idea of just calling in random bike racks and the owner's waking up one day
right,
having a bike rack.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen.
Okay. It's probably all for the best.
Yeah, I guess so. Also, the city only installs bike racks in areas zoned commercial or multifamily. The sidewalk corridor must be at least 9 feet with a 3.5 feet minimum planting strip.
So at least three times as big as my sidewalk.
Yeah. Nowhere on Cesar Chavez will qualify.
Serious.
Check out our guide to installing bike racks in the public right-of-way if you really want to get in the weeds.
Yeah.
Chris in Arcata. Do you or Aaron know of a really good selection of Brooks saddles? I've never owned one before and would like to get one for my Brompton. I'll be visiting at the end of March. Do you know of shops that have a generous Brooks saddle inventory to choose from?
Yes, we do, as a matter of fact.
I can't think of a bike shop right off the top of my head that doesn't have a selection of Brooks saddles.
Yeah, if you're looking for a good leather English saddle, Portland, Oregon apparently is the place to be. Don't know why. No, but there was one thing that I thought of in particular, actually. Wallingford Bicycle Parts is the one that I was noting here. It's okay. Actually, it's out of Louisiana, I believe, New Orleans. But did I say that right?
Sure.
New Orleans. Yeah, I believe that was where Adele ordered one of hers, because they offer this, it's like a free replacement sort of program. Basically, if you don't know if you're going to like it or not, they give you a 6-month guarantee, like a warranty sort of system. So if you order the saddle and you find you don't like it, you can send it back to them and they will either refund you or find a way to make you happier with a saddle.
Right on.
So thank you so much. Really appreciate it. It was great. Have a good safe walk back.
All right. Have a good Sunday.
I'll send you an email. Thank you, Steve.
See you later. Thank you.
He's going to get ice cream when he gets home.
Yeah, it's true. Sundays. anyways, the idea that basically, you know, a lot of people will not order anything, really, like any part that you haven't tried before. If you don't know that you're going to like it, you might not buy it.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with Brooks is... That's what prevented me, well, that and money, is what prevented me from getting a Brooks is, you know, I'm not entirely sure what Brooks is right for me.
Sure.
So to speak.
Yeah. Is it the B-17? Is the B-17 with springs?
Is it the Sparrow? Is it the...
Is it the new vegan saddle that they make?
Right.
Yeah.
I really like that one.
It sounds cool. So, yeah, basically, there's that one there. That's a great online option. If you are coming to Portland to buy a saddle... Gladys Bikes has a saddle rental or a saddle library where you can try out different saddles and find out which one you would like to purchase. That requires you being in town for a little bit longer, but that's also a pretty cool idea. And we're going to be talking to the lady from Gladys Bikes in just a couple weeks, I believe. So that's coming up. Other than that, Clever Cycles, Velocult, and Universal Cycles, we're big fans of all of those, and they have Brooks saddles.
Joe Bike as well.
That's right.
Yeah. Like I said, I can't think of a shop that doesn't. And in all honesty, like, you can't be in Portland and not trip over a Brooks saddle distributor. Yeah.
You will find at least seller. One somewhere.
Yeah. But yeah, if you're already planning on checking out Clever Cycles, like you had said earlier, Chris, I would say, yeah, definitely check them out. Last time I was there, they had like a huge inventory, like all on one wall there.
It's a beautiful sight.
Yeah.
I believe Velocult has the best display of old Brooks advertising.
Oh, right. They have all the vintage advertising.
Yeah. There's like, I think in the bathrooms and somewhere else. I think there's like just a portrait of old elder Mr. Brooks with his huge, glorious beard somewhere near the bar.
That sounds familiar.
So, yeah. And this goes not only for Chris, but also for anyone else who happens to be coming through Portland. If you are here in Portland, let us know. We'd
have a drink with you.
Yes, we would like that.
Okay. Also, should we talk about riding bikes with the Dutch?
Let's talk about riding bikes with the Dutch. Yeah, Chris recommended this to us, and he paid for the video rental for us to watch it, so we did. And it was a cool little documentary.
Yeah. So, also, thanks for the donation for the video rental.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, for sure. It was only about 35 minutes, something like that.
Yeah.
It had great coverage of this one person's experience with bicycling in Amsterdam. It was Amsterdam, right?
Yes.
In Holland. And then also kind of the development of, particularly in Long Beach, I think, was kind of the focus of his experience.
Yes.
But Long Beach and San Diego, kind of Southern California, but the viability of bicycling as a transport option. So,
yeah. One thing that really struck me was how slow they bike over in Amsterdam.
Yeah, for sure.
Nobody's in a hurry over there. I think that's cool. It's probably something I would have to get used to were I to ever spend an extended amount of time over there biking.
For sure.
And that's maybe just, it's more of a cultural thing of not being in a hurry versus, you know, I get on my bike, even just to go to the grocery store, it's very hard for me to just kind of make a leisurely stroll out
sure.
of it.
Sure. It's not a race, I guess.
Yeah. I have like kind of a little bit of tension, not just with this film, but just the way bicycling culture here in America versus bicycling culture over in Amsterdam. And okay, I had never been over there to really experience it firsthand, but we tend to compare ourselves with them a lot. And I can see why, because we see them as like being sort of this bike capital because right. so many people
and a Shangri-La over there. Yeah, like this is the best it's ever been.
Right. Because what is it, like over 50% or?
I forget the numbers. It's a lot of people using bikes.
Around 50%. Anyways.
And all kinds yeah. of people. That's the other big piece of it is that, like, you know, whoever.
Right. From little kids to the elderly to, yeah, the poor and the rich. Yeah, it crosses so many barriers, socially, economically, age.
Just a way of life.
Yeah. But I think by constantly comparing ourselves, I think we also sometimes fail to kind of make the bike and making bike infrastructure our own. You know,
right.
They do it right. And I think there's a lot of good lessons that we can take from them. But also, we aren't Amsterdam and we need to like learn how to like make it ours.
Definitely.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, to do something in the way that we. That works for us in our context.
Yeah.
Which this film did cover Long Beach pretty well.
Yeah.
Their effort to make Long Beach a bikeable city, a place where people wanted to ride bikes and where it was a viable alternative. Which is, I think we joked that it should have been called Riding Bikes Like the Dutch. Because a big piece of the film talks about, like, you know, this is what's happening in America and this is how it could happen. This is how it could be useful to us. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pardon that cold.
That's all right.
Still with me.
It is winter.
Yeah, I was really encouraged just with the big changes that had happened over there in Long Beach in the short amount of time that this movie or documentary sort of covers. It was just like a few years, right?
I believe so, yeah.
It was less than 10, I know that.
Yeah, but, yeah. Within the space of about 5.
That sounds
give or take.
Right.
Yeah.
But so. Yeah. Again, thanks for the recommendation of writing or of watching this movie and for the donation.
For sure.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Chris.
Next, Bill Lasher finds it. Dr. Jeff predicted it. this is us tweeting to
right,
Dr.
This
Jeff.
Is, yes.
So seems Dr. Jeff is a prophet for predicting the singles car speed dating on public transit. Oh, yes.
Yeah. And thanks to Bill Lasher for finding this one.
Okay. And so then you provide a link to where...
Yeah, I believe this is down in...
It won't click on the
link. Oh, right. Sorry, it's an image.
Yeah.
Yeah, apparently this is down in California. Someone is putting together this event where there's going to be a singles car on every train at various intervals. People get on. If you're single, you go to this car and you do some speed dating. So why not?
Yeah, well, nothing like spending, you know, yeah. 5 awkward minutes with somebody that you're going to spend another 3 more awkward days on a train with.
I suppose you're right. Oh, no, this is public transit, though. This is like...
Okay.
So you have the alternative
I'm thinking
of just like disappearing into the large city once you're done.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
It's better than a singles car on Amtrak.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Where was I at here?
Oh, and Dr. Jeff's quote here. That's the only one of my predictions that's even come close to reasonable, he says. Because I think the other one was like a stripper car.
Oh.
There are poles on the max here
in
Portland.
There are poles on the max. I've seen people hang and swing from them.
And a matter of fact, I believe it is legal for anyone of any gender to be shirtless on public transit. That's been codified and accepted.
Yeah, and pantsless.
Right. But I believe that there has to be something about lewd conduct somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
So,
I'm sure.
Yeah.
And that's the end of our mail.
That's it.
That's the end of all things.
Well, hey, anyone in Portland, good luck getting through the slush for the rest of the week. We look forward to a greener Portland on the other side.
Wear thicker socks than I wear.
Are you really?
Oh, these are so thin.
Oh, man. I'm sorry.
I was originally wearing 2 socks. That's a whole other story.
Okay. Well, oh, and you get to wear your favorite pair of rain boots, which is TriMet.
I'm going to use that. That's great.
All right. I call it my rain jacket sometimes, or my fenders, you know. When it rains, I take the bus. All right. Not really. Let's close out.
Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send feedback about the program and suggestions for topics and or guests and or drinks. write to us via email. The address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Or call and leave us a message at 503-847-9774. Connect with us on Twitter at Sprocket Podcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for providing our theme music. Thanks to Herbird for our headline sounder. And thanks again to Shadowfoot and Logan Smith for their reoccurring donations.
What's that in the sky? It's Radar Doppler. Ah!
The rain in Spain falls mostly on the plain.
What happened to your music?
Oh, you know what? It's gone. I think my palm turned it off.
Oh.
Well,
so be
here we are. I don't know what it is about this particular file.
You guys keep everything in the cloud. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah.
And this door is a little bit sticky, so let me make sure.
Pre-open it.
Yeah. Should be if it was the winter or the summertime, you would think it would be swelling from heat, but apparently the wintertime is when it gummed itself up, so I don't know why. Anyways, here come the headlines. A Sprocket Studios production.